Take the end of the robber baron period in American history, add the Mexican Revolution of the early 20th century, add railroads and ranches and a kidnapping, and shake well. The result, perhaps, is a new novel called El Paso. El Paso is in the city in Texas on the Mexican border. We don't talk to a lot of fiction authors on the exchange, but we could not pass up a chance to talk to this one because the author of El Paso is Winston Groom, who is a prolific author of both fiction and nonfiction works. His nonfiction books, including a handful about 19th century wars and warriors, now outnumber the works of fiction, but one novel in particular outsold the others, and that would be Forrest Gump. Winston Groom, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me on.
So I got to love the dedication. You seem to revel in the heroes and scoundrels of history.
Well, that's what it's made up of.
Truly, and you actually wrote the dedication in the book to a granddaughter who shares the love of the heroes and scoundrels?
That's my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
That's my daughter. She's now a freshman in college.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to come into my office and, "Papa, what are you working on?" And I try to explain, "Well, I'm working on a story about cowboys and Indians, or I'm working on a story about this, that, and the other." And finally, I think she's gotten the message.
Give us a sense of your particular attraction to the 19th century and the younger America that we find there.
Yeah, well, I mean, this coincidentally, this story is set 100 years to the year of 2016, set in 1916, which was the year of one of the years of the Pancho Villa Revolution in Mexico. They had so many revolutions, they were more or less in a state of eternal war there for a long time. And Villa Revolution was in northern Mexico, along the U.S. borders, and he at some point actually attacked one of the American cities, Columbus, New Mexico, which prompted the United States government to go after him, which we did. Yeah, we caught him, but we chased him all over the place. And this story was suggested to me by a bunch of tales an old friend of mine used to tell me in New York. We'd have lunch, and he liked to talk about his family. They were the Morgan family, and I think they were distant relatives to J.P. Morgan. But his family owned a big spread down in the state of Chihuahua in Mexico, some 1.5 million acres or something. It had a lot of cows on it. And one time, Pancho Villa decided he was going to go on this piece of property and molest the people that had it, and he strung up the ranch manager and had him sabered to death and kidnapped his children. And anyway, these stories sort of rattled around in my brain for, oh, years, 20 years, I suppose. And just a collection of stories doesn't really make a novel. And anyway, I finally sat down a couple of years ago. I said, I'm going to see if I can put this together, because it's just it's an interesting period in time, and there were some interesting characters. And so I invented a whole bunch of people and set them into motion, and this El Paso is a result of it.
So that's a really interesting process to me to hear about the idea of creating these characters that can help kind of bridge the gaps in the stories that you had rattling in your head for 20 years.
Well, the stories that I had rattling in my head really were just a small part of the book. And as it turned out, is very often those things happen that way. When you actually sit down to do the writing, at least was the way I do it, the story suddenly takes a character of its own, and if you can fit the little true stories in, that's fine. If you can't, don't worry about it, because you can always make things up. That's the beauty of being a novelist.
Yeah, it's unusual for a novel to have a foreword, as you point out, in a foreword here. What's the gist of what you wanted people to know as you start the book?
Well, I just want to give them the setting and that the historical facts are that back in those times, most of northern Mexico, well, I say most, but a good deal of it was owned by very wealthy Americans, because the Mexican government was unable to provide any infrastructure. They were in this state of almost constant revolution, and so they sold big tracts for practically nothing to Harriman, say, who built railroads, and Guggenheims, who established mines, copper mines and silver mines and so forth. And the Morgans were cattle ranching, and the Hearst and the Herreras and various other people, Whitney, they owned a good deal of it. And Pancho Villa had pretty much left him alone until in 1916, President Wilson decided to recognize his arch enemy as a legitimate ruler of Mexico, which cut off his supplies at El Paso, his military munitions and supplies for his army. And so he then started to attack the Americans, Pancho Villa did. And that was that's sort of the impetus for the story.
It's interesting to think about the great families that we know now by the names of the civic works they've done, like the Guggenheim Museum and the Getty Museum, forgetting that the Guggenheims were involved in mining, I think you said, the Getty's involved in oil and so forth.
Yeah, they were quite wealthy, these families that I mentioned. And you mentioned something about robber barons before. I'm not sure these people were robber barons. That was some term coined, I think, by Ida Tarbell, one of the muckraking journalists of the day. I mean, some of them may have been, and they were certainly ruthless in their pursuit of capitalism, but as far as being robbers or thieves, I don't think that most of them were not that. But they were ruthless business people.
All right. And we'll talk about the ruthless business people that you invented for the story of the Shaughnessy family when we come back. Winston Groom is our guest. His latest book is called El Paso. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the prolific author Winston Groom. He's done works of fiction and nonfiction, including Forrest Gump, his famous novel turned into a movie. He's written another novel now called El Paso, which takes us back to 100 years ago on the U.S.-Mexican border and Pancho Villa, getting into face-offs with wealthy American families who own a lot of territory in that part of Mexico at that time. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the contents of this book or the process of writing generally. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you introduce a fictitious railroad and a fictional family, the New England and Pacific. As a railroad buff, I appreciate the railroading angle here. And the Shaughnessy family, and so the relationships already get interesting by page five here. So Arthur Shaughnessy, who's the son and the heir to the Shaughnessy fortune and the operating head of the New England and Pacific, where did he come from originally?
You talk about the one that came from the orphanage?
Exactly.
Yes, okay, yeah. I didn't know what you said. I confused it with his father. But, yes, he was an orphan and adopted by this wealthy railroad owner, and he never quite felt comfortable in that role. But he just dutifully studied the railroad business, and he was a pretty, I say sheltered probably isn't the word for it, but it's close. He sheltered himself. He was a butterfly collector and a stamp collector and things like that. And he was not a big athlete, but he finds along the course of this tale himself having to endure the hardships of the trail and this enormous manhunt through the High Sierras after Pancho Villa, who has kidnapped his children. And he learns something about himself, and everybody learns something about him during this episode.
Absolutely. How rough and threadbare a life did Arthur Shaughnessy live in the orphanage as you depict it?
Well, it was probably typical of the. I'm not an expert on orphanages, but I think back in those days, it was not. It was pretty threadbare. I mean, they were taken care of by charity, but they got three square meals, but they weren't very good meals, and there was very little for them. They were wards of the city, in this case in Boston, and. So he was 10 when he was adopted, which is rather old, I think, for for most kids. Most kids had, by that age, orphans had given up the idea that they were going to be adopted. But he was, and luckily so.
Well, and then the way you write the story, though, that the Shaughnessys, John Shaughnessy and his wife, already had a girl child. They just didn't have a boy who could be the heir to the business. Is that the reason they adopt?
That was the thinking behind it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Arthur dutifully learns the railroad business that he'll eventually inherit from John, but he's got some reservations about it. I mean, aside from the fact that he's got other interests, what's his view of the way his father runs the railroad?
Well, the old man was pretty freewheeling. He had actually almost run the thing to the ground. He won the railroad in a bet, gambling game and a card game, and it was basically a milk run then, a milk train in Massachusetts, and he expanded it all the way out way past Chicago. Probably expanded it too much, and it was successful for a good while. These waves of immigrants would come. Scandinavians and Middle Europeans and Eastern Europeans, and they would go out the line and establish little towns, and they were farmers essentially. But then all that sort of came to an end, a very slow end. But the Great Plains had some very ferocious weather in the 1880s and 1890s, it drove a lot of these people away. And the father didn't adapt quite, and he was also very extravagant. He had one of the world's largest private yachts. And the son just thought that all these things were bad for business, and in fact they were. And the railroad was at this point in danger of actually meeting its payroll. But it's just another layer of tension that I try to bring to the story, but all this is surpassed by the kidnapping of these two children, which was, of course, a more immediate problem.
Absolutely. Winston Groom, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the details of his novel, El Paso. I want to ask about the Shaughnessys a little more, though, because I'm curious to know how they compare. They certainly seem to catch up in extravagance, but how about an actual wealth compared to like the Vanderbilts and the true deep money families of the day?
Oh, I wouldn't think they were nearly as wealthy as Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt had an enormous amount of money, but there comes a time when you can only spend so much of it. I mean, some of it just becomes superfluous. But I think the Shaughnessys would have been among the wealthiest. They were not the most socially prominent because, well, Shaughnessy was his father was an Irishman, and old Boston, being an Irishman, didn't exactly get you to the top of the ladder club wise. But they were an extremely well off family, and of course had sitting on a million acres down in Mexico and probably several hundred thousand head of cattle, among the other things that they owned. So you can imagine they were probably in the top 1%, I guess the expression they use today.
Okay, we'll call them 1%ers. That's fair.
So, yeah, 1%.
So on the first trip you take us south of the border in the novel, Pancho Villa is thinking about Halley's Comet from a couple of years previously. Why is that still stuck in his mind?
Well, not often you get to see a comet. I've only seen one, mm-hmm. and it's still stuck in my mind. But I think Pancho Villa was a lot of Mexicans were superstitious about these things. And he's viewed it as an omen, but he wasn't quite sure what kind of omen it was. And he believed in ghosts. And, of course, a lot of this stuff is just made up. You know, you got to realize this is a novel. It's not history.
Sure.
But I don't know if Pancho Villa believed in ghosts or not, mm-hmm. but he does in this story. And he would not be, it would not be unusual for him to.
So he and his gang, as we first meet Pancho Villa, are about to raid the Shaughnessys' cattle. I mean, had there been something like peace between Pancho Villa and the rich Americans, either in real life or in the novel, for a while?
Well, as I said, he had left Americans pretty much alone for his career, but he became angry that President Wilson, who denied him his source of supplies. And I mean, one of the things he did was, and this is a fact, he seized a bunch of Guggenheim's mining engineers, I think about a dozen or eight, maybe it was 18 or something, and burned them to death in a tunnel. So he was that kind of a fellow. I mean, he was a very dangerous man.
Wow. No kidding. All right, so we obviously have the scoundrels, the likes of Pancho Villa, but some of the heroes as well, including a bunch from real life. How did Tom Mix, the movie cowboy, get in here?
Well, there's a rumor, and that's all I know about it. That's the good thing about writing novels is that I've got a bit of literary license here, I think. There was a rumor that he had gone in his early years and had ridden with Pancho Villa, and then there's the crusty old journalist Ambrose Bierce. He was down there. That is a known fact. I think he went down in 1913 or 14, and he vanished. So whether or not he ever got up with Pancho Villa, I don't personally know. But in my book, he certainly does. And John Reed, the socialist journalist, he was, in fact, down there. He went to write a story about Pancho Villa and the revolution. So there are people. When I began the book, I sort of dropped these people in as cameos, and some of them got to stay because they work well with the story, and others just remain cameos, like George Patton, General Pershing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, yeah. I noticed Patton and Pershing in there too. Give us a sense of the overall process. I mean, do you decide when you're getting to work on a novel what the ending is going to be? And I mean, is it well outlined for you, or do you get a few players and circumstances together and begin moving forward from there?
Well, I try to get the ending. It's like writing a whodunit. If you don't know whodunit, you're going to have a mess on your hands. But it doesn't have to be graven in stone. I wanted sort of general. I just got in my head, this is where it's going to wind up. But there are a lot of strings to be tied up at the end, mm-hmm, that I didn't anticipate at the beginning. But it's a process that the only book I've ever written where I did not have any kind of outline or anything was Forrest Gump. But I mean, most of the novels I write, I sort of know where I wanted to go.
What made Forrest Gump different in the writing of that?
Hell, I don't know. I started writing it, and it wrote itself. I just get up in the morning and I say, "Well, what's he going to do today?" And I never had that happen before. I never had it happen since. I remember Joe Heller told me one time that Catch 22 was like that. I'm not sure I believed him, but this one, it felt like the right thing to do. To just let it go and just see what, you know, any kind of whimsical thing that I felt like putting in there, let it carry me along. I was just, I think it came from what I call a lizard brain, which is in the back of your neck.
Uh-huh.
It flowed right through the regular brain and then down into the, you know, on the 10 fingers and onto the keys.
Uh-huh. Your ancient brain then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Winston Groom is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. As you heard, he's the author of Forrest Gump years ago and the author of a new novel called El Paso that brings together railroads and ranches and revolutionaries and all sorts of other characters and entities along the Mexican border. About 100 years ago, 1916 is the setting. Pancho Villa's in here, some made-up characters, some real folks as well. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this particular novel and process more generally with Winston. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Particularly interested in Pancho Villa. I mean, you just mentioned some of the atrocities that he committed in real life, and I just wonder if in the process of putting him in your book, if you wanted to make him smarter or meaner or more compassionate or anything, if you just kind of took what you found.
Well, you know, there's been a lot written about him, and most of it is junk. People just made up stories, and but there are a couple of good biographies. I can't even remember their names right now because it's been so long since I read them. But I got a sense that he was, he's like most people like that. There was a soft side to him. He could be polite and he could be reasonable. And on the other hand, I think that at one point, somebody made him a bet. They were walking down the street, and he bet that he couldn't shoot the eye out of a man who was sitting on the balcony with his wife. And he won the bet. But then he felt compassionate about the widow, and so he gave her the proceeds of the bet. He was that kind of a guy.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, life was very cheap in those times. As a matter of fact, it's cheap now. I mean, you look at those drug gangs, and they're taking over so much of Mexico. I hope they can get rid of them. But back then, it was a hard life, and then you died.
All right. And, yeah, as you point out, though, some modern-day parallels in Mexico. So back to the story, though, of El Paso, and we're talking about John Shaughnessy, the rich railroad owner who won his railroad in a bet and spends money extravagantly. Was Colonel Shaughnessy, and why? First of all, why is he called Colonel? And second of all, was he modeled after somebody in the real world?
Well, he really wasn't. I mean, he was sort of loosely, I mean, there's nobody that I can think of that was not, I don't put a name to it, but he had, in the story, he had ridden with Rumsfeld's Rough Riders in the Cuban War, the Spanish-American War. And I even forget now whether they just used Colonel as a sobriquet or he was actually a colonel. I think maybe he was an officer of some sort. And they call it like a Kentucky colonel. The people called him Colonel. And he had I think maybe raised a regiment or something, or a company, and gone down to the Spanish-American War. So that's why he was called a colonel.
And the level of detail that you provide from him is really interesting, because just some things that he does, like he gets annoyed when he has to bring his yacht back to Newport at his son's contact. He wants to hold a canned hunt with his friends before the sun gets in his eyes. He's got a mounted elephant's head in the house, etc. So a lot of things that make you realize this is not the kind of guy you might want to spend a lot of time with. And I wonder just in general, Winston, what it's like to—I mean, if it's harder to create a character who's generally pretty likable because there's less level of detail or something.
Well, I didn't set out to make him unlikable. He was a very imperious sort of a fellow. Somebody on an earlier show today, I was talking to a host, suggested, said that the person who would play General Shaughnessy Colonel Shaughnessy in a movie would be John Huston. And I hadn't thought about that, but I think that would have been an excellent match.
Yeah.
But he was that kind of a guy, you know, he was a sort of larger-than-life character. He'd done it all. He owned a railroad. He'd been an officer in the Spanish-American War. He had, you know, raised his family there in Boston in a proper part of town, and he was quite the guy, and he thought big. You might even think he's a Donald Trump sort of a character, but I think he's different than Trump. Mm-hmm. He made it the hard way, and I don't know. I just, there was something about him that I found compelling, that I wanted to contrast him with his son, who really is more or less the star of the show, I think. He's never really satisfied with his son. He always envisioned that the son would be a perfect mirror of himself, and it turned out he wasn't. His son didn't care much for hunting or fishing or wild things. He was sort of kept to himself and did his job. And they get to know each other in a pretty whole different way on the trail.
Absolutely. And in fact, the response to hearing that Villa is starting to cause problems along the border is to go down to Mexico. But what's the way they choose to go?
Well, they go on a train. He has a private rail car. And And matter of fact, these stories that my friend Eddie Morgan would tell me, that was about his grandfather. And they would go, he learned it from his great uncles. They would go down on this private train, and some of the stories that I told, the story about buying the bear in Nashville, that was a true story. And he had it on the train, it escaped, he got in the dining car. And just a lot of things like that. They went down to Mexico first class.
All right, much more to talk about with Winston Groom. His latest novel is called El Paso. We'll talk more about El Paso itself and the process of writing and creating all the many books that Winston Groom has created over the years. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Winston Groom, the prolific author of both fiction and nonfiction works. His nonfiction books include a handful about 19th century wars and warriors, and they outnumber actually the works of fiction, but he's best known perhaps for Forrest Gump, which obviously has been out for a few years and was made into a movie, El Paso. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but you can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we've got this this family of railroad barons, the Shaughnessys, father John, son Arthur. They own property in Mexico. They're going down to Mexico because Pancho Villa is causing problems for the people, the wealthy Americans who own land along the Mexican border. I want to take in one more character before we head south, though, and that is Mick Martin, who's an old friend of Arthur Shaughnessy's. Tell us about him.
Well, he was a friend from the orphanage. Very interesting sort of a guy. He was always very handsome, athletic, all the things that Arthur wasn't supposed to be. And they remained friends for a long time. And then Mick, without giving too much away, I'd say, commits a very terrible act involving Arthur's wife. And so not only does he have to deal with the situation with the kidnapped children, he's got to deal with this. And it all starts to come to a head as the story moves along. And Mick Martin comes back into the picture.
Yeah, he's certainly an interesting character in childhood and the ways in which he pushed and protected Arthur. It's fun to watch that stuff. To the real characters, I mean, to the people who really do appear in real life, I mean, you mentioned you got artistic license, but, I mean, do you put a fair amount of research into John Reed and Ambrose Bierce and Pancho Villa himself?
Well, not nearly as much as I would as I would say doing a full-blown biography or something. But I familiarized myself with them. I read what they wrote in the case of Bierce and Reed. And I read biographies of them, and same thing with Pancho Villa. But at some point you sort of put all that aside and make a character sketch in your mind about what kind of person you want this to be, and you get to give them a voice, a certain way they speak, a certain way they look, and how they react to things. And then once you do that, you own them.
You mentioned talking to another interviewer who mentioned that Colonel Shaughnessy could have been played by John Huston, which does sound like a good choice based on that. And I wonder if as you write a novel, if you do think about your characters in terms of people that you know or people who have appeared on movie screens?
I don't know. I mean, one of the things I learned a long time ago, and it was actually James Jones told me this, we were having a conversation when he rewrote From Here to Eternity, various books. And he said, when I write my first novel, and he said, whoever your main character is, make him as different from yourself as possible, and as different from people that you know as possible, because there will probably come a time when that character has to do something that would be out of character for you or people that you know, and then you'll be in a fix, because it's not going to seem real. And I think that was good advice, and I've tried to follow it. As far as writing for movies, I don't do that. I think it's a mistake. I mean, I think they do what they do, and they do it pretty well. And I do what I do, and I do it pretty well. Mm-hmm. And if they want to go and see my literary agency about buying the property of mine, fine. And I'll believe it when I spend the money. But as far as writing for different actors, I mean, that's a fruitless task, I think, because you have no way of knowing anything, you know. Now, maybe other writers do that. I don't know. I just don't do it. Mm-hmm. I try to get the character straight in my mind as who I want him to be, and not the way some actor might portray him.
Okay, so there's no like, as Forrest Gump is going to, yeah, I think Tom Hanks would look pretty good in this role. There's none of that. You just deal with the straightforward stuff of the characters.
That's what I try to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way I do it, but doesn't mean it's a bad thing to do it another way. It's just everybody's got a method, and that's mine.
How long a process to write a book like El Paso? Because, I mean, it's a lengthy book. I mean, it really does move along, don't get me wrong, but a lot of different details in here. It's divided into several sections and a lot of characters and circumstances to take in. I just wonder from start to finish how big a process this was.
Well, if you say that from the time that I started hearing these stories from my friend Eddie to the time I finished it, that's 20-something years.
Wow.
But from the time that I actually sat down to do it and said, all right, I'm going to pull all this stuff together and I got to make this a daily process, it took a couple of years to get it right. The first draft I had was way too long. And when I looked at it, I said, I just think I can go through this and cut. That's not easy to cut your own stuff.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But it's far better than having somebody else do it. So anyway, I just sat down. That took a couple of weeks just to go through it line by line and condense it. And I took about maybe a third of it out, maybe more than that.
Mm-hmm. So at top speed, I mean, about how many pages a day were you cranking out?
Oh, you know, sometimes you get a page, and sometimes you get 5 or 6 pages. But for anything more than 5 or 6 pages, I tend to throw away. It's just your mental process is only so good for so long, and at least that's the way it is with me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I write 10 pages, and I go back and read them the next morning, I'll say, you know, after 5 pages, you could tell where it dropped off. So. It adds up if you do it every day, and I don't do this for a hobby, so I try to hit a lick on it every day I can, and I feel like I want to give it the best I can get, and after about 5 pages, which is about 700 or 800 words, something like that,
mm-hmm.
that's about as much as I can give it in a day and have it really sing, have it be seamless.
So as the creator of a novel, in a sense, you're the god of a little universe. So you want to make sure that everything works right, makes sense. There's rationality and order to this universe. But I also wonder if there's an element of you as a writer who gets a certain amount of glee from, I don't know, punishing the wicked or something, or rewarding the good in your stories.
Well, yeah. I mean, learned in the book, there's a lot of ways to kill people.
Yes, indeed.
I'm not a sadist or anything, but I think that the world has some order in it. I mean, that's my world picture if I say I have one, and it's a just order in the long run. Although it may seem unjust at times, it may be unjust at times, but in the end, in my stories, I mostly have the good guys winning. And I think that's an important element. I mean, I don't really have a message. I always like to say, if you want a message, you call Western Union.
Right, yeah.
Twitter now, I guess it is today. But I just try to tell an interesting story where at the end the reader will say, I'm glad I read that. I learned something.
Mm-hmm. So who are some of the people who inspired you? I'm curious to know who are some of the people who you had that feeling about when you read their works.
Well, in college, when I was in school, if you went through the English department, which I did, at some point you're going to encounter Faulkner and Hemingway and Fitzgerald. I don't know what they teach today. But those were early books that I had read. And then when I started my first book, my first novel, I'd been a journalist for 10 years in Washington. And I thought, well, I didn't want to do that the rest of my life. So I did something that was, I think, rather bold. I went in and resigned and told them why, that I was going to write a book. I knew I'd burn my bridges at that point. I'd be too embarrassed if I failed to come back and ask for my job again. And so I read the best. And at that point, would be Irwin Shaw, who wrote The Young Lions and Rich Man, Poor Man, and James Jones, wrote From Here to Eternity and The Thin Red Line, and Kurt Vonnegut and Joe Heller, and Lord, they all turned out to be neighbors of mine out in the Hamptons where I was living, and friends. And that was really, for a young writer, that was writer's paradise.
Mm-hmm, no doubt.
But they're all gone now. But they were, you know, because I'd never written a novel before, and I had to have some kind of structure. So I read theirs and so tried to figure out how they did it. And they were all different. They structured it in a certain way, and but I applied myself to try to understand how they could do that, and I think it stood me in pretty good stead because that book was pretty successful.
Well, you mentioned being a journalist in Washington. I wonder if there have ever been any regrets over the years about leaving that, since we consistently seem to live in interesting times with the focus on Washington.
Well, I don't have any regrets at all. I like Washington, but I was there during the most interesting of the times. I was there during Watergate and the riots and the Nixon's presidency, Johnson's presidency. On through, I guess, Ford, I suppose, or yeah. Carter, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And Carter. I remember that was my last days there, was his inauguration. But I don't miss that part of it, no.
Mm-hmm.
It is. There's a lot of unsavory stuff that goes on there. And there's a lot of guessing and speculating, and the newspaper business isn't what it used to be. None of the papers are the same as it used to be. And I think I'll just leave it at that.
Sure, sounds good. So obviously more freedom as a novelist. So what is the best part of researching and writing a big novel?
Finishing it.
So I guess the worst part is still being involved in it.
Well, not really. I mean, it's not like work to me. It's fun. I mean, it's hard. You have to have a lot of alacrity, mental alacrity, and there are times where it will give you grief. But when you're really doing it right, and you know what you're doing, and you can sit there at the end of the day and say, "Okay, I'm proud of what I did today." That, to me, is the most rewarding thing about it. And then at the end of it, you can say, okay, now I have done this, and let's see where it goes from here.
What about doing the publicity tours? I just wonder how much of a rigor that is for you to go through a bunch of interviews and visit a bunch of towns and do readings and signings and all that stuff.
Well, you know, when I was young, it's just starting out, and it was delightful. Get to meet a lot of new people and see a lot of new places, and I've done this 20 times now. it's a grind. I mean, but you do it because that's part of your responsibility, I think, as a writer, to help publicize a book and, you know, get it moving. And I don't mind doing it. It's just some of it becomes quite tedious.
No doubt. no doubt. Just about a minute left here. I want to ask before we go about Forrest Gump in particular. I mean, obviously, years now that it's been out there and a highly popular movie. Does the or did at some point the popularity and the durability of it surprise you?
Yeah. I mean, most movies obviously don't have that durability in popularity. There was something there that just clicked, and every once in a while, Hollywood will really get it right, and they get this magic combination of people and a script that works and a director that has foresight, and this all worked. And so, you know, there it is. I mean, God knows, I've got people. I had a plumber, you know, that had a septic tank problem at a place I have up in the mountains in North Carolina. And after they had done all this work all day long, a man knocked on the door, and he said, "Mr. Green," he said, "you got a minute?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Can I do a Forrest Gump, my Forrest Gump imitation for you?" And I said, "Yeah, go ahead." And that's what he did.
That's great.
I get that about once or twice a year.
Once or twice a year. Good to know. Winston Groom, thanks so much for joining us today. Very much appreciate your time with us.
Well, thanks for having me.